Greg Berg. Let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. Major League Baseball, Brewers lose to the Pirates 7-0. Cubs and Cardinals were both idle, so a little change in the NL Central standings. Cubs stay in first. Brewers drop to third place, now 2.5 out. Cardinals stay in second place alone, 2 games out. White Sox beat Kansas City 11-3. Tonight, the Brewers and the Pirates again at Miller Park. Cubs and the Mets down at Wrigley, and the White Sox have an afternoon game in Kansas City. NFL, Minnesota beat New Orleans 29-19. Denver beat the Chargers 24-21. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Tuesday, September 12th. Sunny and seasonal, today's high 75. All right, now the sun is shining, wind is calm. It is 46 degrees at 8:10. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And support for the Morning Show also comes from Carthage College's Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.
We're going to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show probing through the history of our Constitution. And this is a document, of course, that affects all of our lives, but it's also a document that most of us do not begin to properly understand. And in particular, I think most of us have only the sketchiest notion of how the Constitution took shape. And some interesting questions about that are answered in a very interesting new book called Fault Lines in the Constitution: The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. The authors of the book are Sanford and Cynthia Levinson, and they have done a terrific job of helping clarify the sometimes murky picture behind how our U.S. Constitution took shape. Cynthia Levinson has authored a number of books for young readers, including We've Got a Job, the 1963 Birmingham Children's March, Watch Out for Flying Kids, How Two Circuses, Two Countries, and Nine Kids Confront Conflict and Build Community, and Hillary Rodham Clinton, Do All the Good You Can. Sanford Levinson is a highly regarded American legal scholar and a professor in the law school and department of government at the University of Texas. And he is the author of a number of adult works of nonfiction, including An Argument Open to All, Reading the Federalist in the 21st Century, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. This book, again, is called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. The book is published by Peachtree Publishers. Cynthia Levinson, Sanford Levinson, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That seems like a funny question to ask, but I think I'll get it out of the way. I am blithely assuming that you are husband and wife, but that doesn't necessarily, just because your last name is Levinson doesn't mean that that's necessarily the case. Could you just say a word about the intriguing mix of experience and expertise which each of you bring, and what it was like to collaborate on this book together?
Well, as you said, I write for young readers, and Sandy writes about the Constitution. It was our editor, Kathy Landwehr's, idea that the two of us team up on this book. Our agent, Aaron Murphy, wondered if our marriage would survive the book, and in the acknowledgments, I said, yes, it appears that a book and a marriage can survive simultaneously. I would have to say that I think Sandy was very patient with me as I got successively exasperated, but at the same time, As I say, he was patient with my revisions, and I learned a tremendous amount myself writing this book and working with Sandy on it. You know, I read his previous works and participated in many conversations about the Constitution and its problems, but it wasn't until we wrote this book together that I really appreciated what he's been talking about, which is the fundamental problems with the U.S. Constitution. I don't know, Sandy, how did you find
it? Cynthia is a justifiably prize-winning author of books written for children and young adults. I would like to think that I write for the general reader, but I think the awful truth is that I write more for my academic colleagues. So the key to this book is that it is she who really wrote it and made it accessible to young readers, though my own hope is that the parents and grandparents of the teenagers who are its kind of official audience will pick it up and get interested themselves in a number of aspects of the Constitution that I suspect they haven't thought much about.
Hmm. I suspect that it was interesting for you, Professor Levinson, to have to take concepts that can be pretty complicated and in a sense allow them to be boiled down, to some extent simplified, although I'm really impressed that this book does not kind of turn complicated matters just into sort of easy mush. I mean, there's a lot of substance here, but what was it like for you to, in a sense, to be thinking about these matters with a very different audience than you are accustomed to dealing with?
It was very informative. Hugo Black, who, of course, was a great justice in the mid-20th century, always gave his non-lawyer wife copies of opinions he was drafting, because his view is that opinions of the court ought to be accessible to ordinary citizens. And his wife served as the target. So I think that, you know, writing for academics is very interesting and a lot of fun, but in fact, the more important thing to do is to make contact with the general citizenry. And Cynthia is very, very good at that. And I don't think we dumbed down the book. I do think Cynthia has a real talent for figuring out how to convey information to bright teenagers.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Cynthia and Sanford Levinson about the book they co-authored called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. I would like you to, either of you or both of you, to try to describe the state of affairs on May 13th, 1787, when a group of delegates first came together in Philadelphia to begin what ultimately was the process of framing the Constitution. What was going on in the land at that moment that necessitated such a move?
Well, I think the key is the tremendous disappointment and frustration over the Articles of Confederation. You were kind enough to mention that I had written a book on the Federalists, reading the Federalists in the 21st century. And one of the themes of that book is that it literally begins, Federalist 1 begins with the statement that everybody agrees that the Articles of Confederation aren't working. And in Federalist 15, Alexander Hamilton would describe the existing government as imbecilic. It couldn't finance itself. There was no reason to believe that it would protect the United States against all sorts of enemies, foreign countries and a number of Indian tribes who, for good reason, weren't very taken by this new government. So I think what primarily motivated the people arriving in Philadelphia is that we were dangerously close to dissolving into two or three separate countries, and something really dramatic had to be done. The next 4 months were spent arguing about what exactly did need to be done, what you could get the votes for. But I think what brought people to Philadelphia was a sense of desperation that the United States was at the brink of failure.
Mm. You're right. They were about to concoct an entirely new and daring kind of government, faults and all. And I think you've just helped us understand the sort of circumstances which drove them to attempt such a thing. I wonder if you could say, go ahead.
Great. They knew that they were, in essence, breaking the law. The Articles of Confederation, on which they were operating to the extent that they or we were, didn't really allow for the revision of the system of government that we had at the time. And they were so desperate, as Sandy said, that they had to ignore that and start from scratch.
I wonder if either or both of you could talk about the relative secrecy under which this took place. And, of course, you've just touched on one of the reasons why. But to what extent there is some uncertainty about exactly what was said and who said what through the course of these proceedings. Because I should think that ends up being a bit of a challenge for anybody like yourself who wants to write about these proceedings.
You're asking two somewhat different and both important questions. The first one is directed really at historians. How confident can we really be about what was said in Philadelphia, what deals were made, what the votes were and the like? And the only honest answer is somewhat. There's nothing resembling the stenographic transcript of the debates. And in fact, a prize-winning book was published last year by a professor at Boston College Law School, really demonstrating beyond shadow of a doubt that James Madison's notes, which are the most frequently used source for historians, are really quite untrustworthy in many respects. So that's something historians have to contend with. But the other question you're asking, in many ways, is even more interesting and important because it gets to our politics today. The most literally incredible thing about the Philadelphia Convention is, as you suggest, that it was entirely secret. They made a pledge among themselves when they convened in May of 1787 to keep quiet. And even the New York delegates who stalked out of the convention in July because they correctly perceived that the convention was controlled by people who wanted a much, much stronger national government than these two delegates did, they were gentlemen, and they kept their word. They didn't, tell any of their friends, oh, my God, you won't believe what's happening in Philadelphia. I don't think in today's world, almost literally, we can't fathom that kind of secrecy. Everybody tweets. Everybody leaks. Everybody publishes memoirs almost instantaneously. They really did keep it secret. And one of the really profound questions that raises is the trade-off between transparency and secrecy with regard to the necessary compromises that are necessary in politics. The more transparent the process, the more difficult it is to make deals.
One of the reasons I think they kept it secret was that it allowed them to take straw votes, which is a process we don't have anymore. They put ideas on the table and considered them, talked about them, and took a sort of feel for the room. But if the room wasn't ready to come to a decision, then they went back out and they were not back out of the room. They stayed in the room the whole sweltering time. But they redrafted we hardly have that opportunity anymore because everything is so public. Yes, there are backdoor deals that go on these days, but that's different from discussing everything openly and allowing the people who are there to feel their way through these issues, express their opinions, but know that they could, in that room, change their minds without being embarrassed or humiliated. Your listeners who have either seen or heard Hamilton the musical may know the line about no one else was in the room when it happened. That's in particular a deal that was made about Washington, D.C. and the banks. So that was a kind of backroom deal. But basically, everything was in the open, but also enclosed.
We're speaking with Cynthia and Sanford Levinson about the book they have co-authored called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. This is a book intended for young readers, but I think readers of all ages will actually find themselves learning a lot about our country and the framing of our Constitution and some of the ways in which that Constitution took shape under very, very difficult circumstances, and how some of the divisions that were part of our nation in its earliest days are still very much with us today and still very much with us in this document. And unfortunately, we won't have time, of course, to thoroughly explore every single facet you explore in your books. In your book, we should talk for sure, of course, about this matter of bicameralism, that is, that we have a bicameral Congress. You begin exploring this in your chapter called It Takes Two to Tango. You really help us appreciate, in a sense, what a complicated structure this is, and yet why it took shape the way it did. I want you to talk in particular about an interesting moment in this chapter when you talk about the word democracy. And how, although we think of that in only the most positive terms now, that back then the term democracy, or a government that was entirely democratic, would not have necessarily been seen as a positive thing.
No, I think that's absolutely right. That democracy doesn't become a really positive word till the mid-19th century. Democracy for many of the framers meant rule by the mob. And the Constitution in many ways was designed to prevent democracy in that sense. One of the people we quote in the book is Elbridge Gerry, who is primarily famous because he gave his name to the term gerrymander or gerrymander, as is also sometimes pronounced. But one of the things he told his fellow delegates in Philadelphia is, quote, the people are dupes, unquote. So I think from then until now, Americans are really torn between two conflicting views of what can happen in government. One view is that we're democratic in a modern sense. And what democracy means is that the majority should rule. If the majority can't rule, then by definition, the effective rule is held by a minority. On the other hand, Americans are taught from a very, very early age to be extremely fearful of tyranny of the majority. So we carry around these two ideas in our minds. And our institutions were designed primarily to prevent majorities from governing. Some of your listeners, especially if they're older, may remember civics courses they took years and years ago where somebody would write on the blackboard how a bill becomes a law. And so they learned it has to pass through both sides of Congress and be signed by the president. In some ways, a central motif of our book is why most bills don't stand the chance of becoming law, because there are so many hurdles that have to be run in order for legislation to pass. If you look at contemporary public opinion polling, you discover across parties, doesn't really matter whether you're Democrat or Republican, doesn't matter whether you're a liberal, conservative, or a centrist, you probably don't feel a great deal of confidence that the national government will respond to whatever you believe are the central problems facing us. Maybe you can get your favorite bill through the House, but then it won't go anywhere in the Senate. Or, as happened with immigration reform in 2010, maybe it will actually get through the Senate with a bipartisan vote and then die in the House. Or maybe it will get through both the House and the Senate and then be vetoed by the president. So I think these are the realities. And you can find quotes from the framers who said, yeah, we're really afraid of what an unchained people might do, so we want to make it really hard for legislation to pass. But in the 21st century, I think there's much, much more frustration about legislation that doesn't pass than there is joy about what legislation actually gets through.
Interesting. I appreciate the fact that the two of you are willing to take on some complicated matters and issues that do not sort of cry out to be written about for young readers. I mean, it's not what we immediately think of as something that a teenager will either be interested in or even, you know, manage to understand. And yet I think you lay out some complicated matters in very clear fashion, even something as complicated and mystifying as why we have an electoral college and why we ultimately elect our presidents by the electoral vote rather than the popular vote, something, of course, which very much was hotly discussed in the wake of this most recent election. In a nutshell, why is it that we have this electoral college system that has so many people mystified and maybe even a bit irritated?
Well, it's not called the Electoral College in the Constitution, but the Constitution does call for a body of people to make the decision. The reason goes back to what the country was like at the time. And given the high proportion of people in the country who live in cities now, it's hard for all of us, let alone kids, to appreciate how dispersed the population was. Largely along the coast, but not entirely. It was a very, very rural population. People hardly knew other people in their vicinity, let alone the state, let alone the entire country. News, for instance, took a long time to get around, generally didn't get around at all. So there probably was no way for the people to know anyone who was nominated or running for the highest office. Also, there was not at the time, and the founders hoped that this would continue to be the case, there was no political party. There were no parties at the time. So they were looking for men, and it was men, of substance and means. But nevertheless, somebody in South Carolina may never have heard of anyone in, say, Massachusetts. So it seemed to make sense to them to have representatives from the state. So people in rural areas and in towns would vote not for the president, whom they'd never heard of before, but somebody more or less local whom they would know of and trust to represent them when they went to vote, because those people they possibly knew or knew of and respected might well know the relatively prominent person who was running for president. So that's how the system came about. That was the rationale for it.
Yeah, there's one more important explanation of the Electoral College, which gets to the central evil in the Constitution, which is slavery. Because the way the Electoral College works, both then and today, is that although everybody within the state is counted in terms of how many representatives and therefore ultimately how many electoral votes a state gets, everybody doesn't vote. And the most dramatic illustration, of course, in 1787 were women and children, but also slaves. And what the Constitution did through the so-called three-fifths rule was to give a bonus to slave states where they got extra members of the House and extra electors. Now, do a fast forward. We don't have slavery anymore, thank God, but we do have voter suppression. We do have the attempts simply to make it difficult to vote. And what this means is that the people who control certain states have no particular incentive to allow everybody to vote. What they want to do is to shape the vote so that their political party will win. There's a real connection between the kind of gerrymandering you see in designing legislative districts, where by definition the political party in power will try to rig the game in behalf of their own party, but also with regard to the Electoral College, the rigging here is simply to try to reduce the vote of the people you don't like. And that was present in 1787, as I say, with regard to giving slave states some extra power, but everybody knew that the slaves were not going to vote. Their function was simply to give white slave owners more political power than they deserved.
One of the other issues that we go into in that chapter is not only the effect of the Electoral College, of course, on the outcome of presidential races, but on the inflow, that is, on the campaigns. The Electoral College has a very pernicious effect on where the candidates go, where they spend money and advertise, and whom they speak to. Entire states are ignored because of the importance to them of swing states. In this past election, Ohio, Pennsylvania, for instance. So the Electoral College has a very thoroughgoing effect that we go into, and I appreciate you saying that it's clear, because it's important for young people who are about to start voting in the next couple of years to know what the ramifications are.
There's one last point I would make with regard to Electoral College. I think we point out in this book, I know that I do in some other things I've written for adult audiences, that every American poll taken since 1944 has indicated that the majority of the public would like to get rid of the Electoral College. So then you ask, well, why didn't we do it? Well, one answer is what you brought up before, bicameralism, that you have to get two-thirds of each House of Congress, and both houses of Congress have never agreed on an amendment to get rid of the Electoral College. But even if you got both houses to agree, you would then have to get three-quarters of the states to agree. And that means that 14 states could block a constitutional amendment. And then you realize, as Cynthia pointed out, some of the battleground states have an incentive not to get rid of the Electoral College, because if they did, candidates would not spend so much time in Florida or Ohio as they now do. But it's also the very small states like the Dakotas and Wyoming that may feel that they want to keep the Electoral College because they get more representation in the Electoral College than their raw numbers would entitle them to. So the amendment, the United States Constitution is almost literally incredibly hard to amend. And the Electoral College is a wonderful example of the point.
Or a terrible example.
Right. Precisely because a majority, I mean, if you believe in democracy, then the Electoral College should have disappeared long ago. But there's basically no doubt that we'll conduct the 2020 election under the Electoral College, and that it's just with us, whether we want it or not.
Mm. Your book, of course, goes on to explore all kinds of other interesting matters related to the Constitution, including this matter of how difficult it is to amend, and a very interesting chapter on how one might grade the Constitution. Just how well did they do in framing this complicated document with which we have to live and somehow govern ourselves effectively. You've given me a lot to think about, and I can well imagine not only young readers, but readers of all ages taking a lot away from your book called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today, published by Peachtree Publishers. The co-authors, Cynthia Levinson and Sanford Levinson.
If we could just make one final point, the book is so timely that we are updating it every 2 weeks. We have a blog, www.faultlinesinthe constitution.com, and we write every 2 weeks about the relationship between current events in the news right now and what happened back in 1787.
Excellent. That's something for people to check out as well. Thank you for mentioning that. Cynthia Levinson and Sandrid Levinson, this was a great pleasure for me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
And the time is 8:41. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, and here is part two. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with one of the country's most talented and successful writers, Steve Barry. You may know that name from a number of best-selling novels that he has written, I think 9 or 10 by now, around the figure of Cotton Malone, and several other novels as well. He's extremely successful. And this latest novel, yet another in the Cotton Malone series, is called The Patriot Threat. And like most of Steve Barry's works, it is rooted in American history. In this particular case, rooted in a reality that involves the laws that brought into being our income tax, and the possibility that if indeed that legislation was somehow fatally flawed, and in fact there is no reason for us to have income tax, think of what a secret, what a powerful secret that could be in the hands of someone who, in a sense, wanted to disable the United States in a fiduciary fashion. That's just one ingredient in this really thrilling novel by Steve Barry, which, by the way, is, in a sense, kind of a book within a book. And we'll explain that in just a moment. The book is published by Minotaur Books. Again, it's called The Patriot Threat. And Steve Barry, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Talk for a moment about this genre in which you are working, that this is not just a novel, but a novel that is, and not just a thriller, but a thriller that is based in history with some intriguing historical facts that are woven into the mix. Talk a moment about this interesting niche in which you like to write.
Yeah, I like to take something from the past, something forgotten, something you may not know anything about, and get you to learn more about it. And that's the hook that I go through. That's the hook as I put it together. And in this case, it was something that happened 100 years ago with the ratification of the 16th Amendment, something that's real, that really did happen. The Solicitor General at the time warned the Secretary of State that there was problems in the ratification process. He told the Secretary of State to move with caution here, but the Secretary of State ignored that advice and declared the 16th Amendment in effect. He didn't declare it ratified, which is very interesting. He said in effect. And the amendment took over. About 20 years ago, someone went behind that to find out what the Solicitor General was actually upset about and discovered something quite shocking. In nearly all 42 states that considered the amendment, there were problems. In 15 of the states, there were problems so severe that they most likely did not even ratify the amendment. You only have to void 6 states to void the amendment. And so it's just this fascinating thing that happened so long ago that could have catastrophic consequences today. So I wove this thriller using this as a weapon against us.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment about the title character, not the title character, but the central character in the novel, for the sake of any of our listeners who are not familiar with who Cotton Malone is.
Yeah, he's a retired Justice Department agent. He lives in Copenhagen. He runs an old bookshop and kind of stays in trouble all the time. He's had 10 adventures now. I don't write them, though, where you have to read them in order or anything. You can read them in any order you want, and I write them almost like standalones in some respects. And so he's been around a little while, and now he gets caught up in this constitutional crisis. And it's for the first time I was able to do the whole thriller in 23 hours. So everything happens in this book really fast. And the reader is going to find out some cool stuff about Franklin Roosevelt and Andrew Mellon and the $1 bill and a painting that hangs in the National Gallery of Art. It's there in Gallery 62. A man named Hyman Solomon, who helped finance the American Revolution. All of this is going to be woven around this constitutional crisis that Cotton gets caught up in. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, because it's a thriller, just about everything that happens is cloaked in a deep veil of secrecy. One of the dynamics that is especially interesting in the book, and I should think to at least some extent very true to life, is the fact that we have, in a sense, different government agencies not fully cooperating with each other, in many cases not cooperating at all.
No.
And being very possessive of the secrets which each of them sort of hold in their pocket, and for understandable reasons to a point, but we're also sort of painted this very vivid picture of how that can really undermine their own respective efforts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're trying to keep your own little secrets in your own little niche. But unfortunately, they're spilling over, and that's part of the novel illustrates that, of how this happens. Treasury Department has a secret in which they don't want anyone else to know. And unfortunately, you know, it gets out, and once it gets out, then it becomes just a disaster across the board, and, you know, everyone's trying to plug this leak as this leak gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, that's part of what I wanted to illustrate somewhat, was the how the left hand and the right hand sometimes in the intelligence business has no idea what they're doing. And in this case, it could have catastrophic consequences because of what's happening out there. I have a rogue North Korean. I was fascinated with North Korea. It's an interesting country I know almost nothing about. And I wanted to learn more about it. I wanted the reader to know more about it. But, you know, really, North Korea can't hurt us. It's more a nuisance than anything else. It's not really anything that causes us any serious harm unless they could get a hold of something that they could use our own laws against us. They could turn our own rules against us. And that's what this rogue North Korean is after. He's after his birthright, and he's going to take America down. And I modeled him after a real guy. The actual leader of North Korea right now was not supposed to be the leader of North Korea. His older brother was supposed to have that job. But his older brother tried to take one of his children and sneak into Japan to go to Disneyland. He got caught, and he embarrassed his father, and his father stripped him of his birthright. And that's why we have the leader we have now. And that older brother still lives in Macau and is still alive, so I loosely based my antagonist on what happened to him.
Mm. And, of course, one of the things that makes him a dangerous figure is because he is widely viewed as shallow and directionless and so on. And in fact, he is a very, very smart man and a very dangerous man because everybody around him so seriously underestimates him.
That's the whole point. And he likes that. He likes to be underestimated. And he works under the radar. And now he's at the point where he's about to pull this off. Unfortunately for him, Cotton Malone gets in the middle of it, and that's where the thriller aspect of all this comes in. But there's a lot of real things in the book. I try to keep my books about 90% to reality. I only trip it up about 10% of the time for the entertainment value. And I have a writer's note in the back, though, that tells you where I trip you up.
Mm. And in other words, it really spells out the whole matter of fact versus fiction.
Yes, and I want you to know that. I don't want you to leave the book thinking something is real and it's not. It's usually the other way around. You're going to think something's false, and you're going to discover that it's real because, as I said, I keep the book about 90% close to reality.
Hmm. We're speaking with Steve Barry about his latest novel, which is called The Patriot Threat. It's one of a number of books which he has written, thrillers involving a figure called Cotton Malone, once an elite intelligence division officer within the Justice Department, and now on his own in semi-retirement, but pulled out of semi-retirement again and again. In fact, talk about the small elite group which he now is affiliated with.
Yeah, I created the Magellan Billet. It was just something I made up one day because I thought, well, why don't the Justice Department have something that can work for the Attorney General and do what needs to be done in a covert way? So I created this concept of the Magellan Billet. Cotton retired out a few years ago, and he moved to Copenhagen, and he runs that old bookshop, but he just can't help it. He just gets keep drawing back in, and I transitioned Cotton a little bit for a while. He was drawn back in because of things happening to his friends and family, those kind of things, these personal reasons to bring him back in, but, you know, after a while, you kind of run out of those, so he's kind of transitioned now into an agent for hire, and he kind of gets hired back in, and for what he thinks is one thing, which quickly becomes something else, and that's what happens here. A simple little meet and greet recon mission turns into this big 23-hour adventure that he has to, you know, go across Venice and Croatia to deal with, while my other character, Stephanie Nell, who heads the Magellan Billet, is in Washington, D.C., dealing with that aspect of it. And all of this is happening simultaneously as this constitutional crisis begins to unravel.
Talk for a moment about constructing a thriller that plays out on several stages simultaneously and stages that are all over the world. I'm really impressed at the clarity with which this novel unfolds, for as complicated as the story in fact is and how tightly packed that story is.
Thank you. I work hard on that because you've got to make sure that what's happening in one side of the world has relevance to what's happening on the other side of the world. And it only has relevance in the reader's mind because the reader is actually privileged to both worlds. And so they're parallel, but they are somewhat intertwined with one another and interconnected, and that's what makes them work, is that interconnection. And I keep that connection going until eventually these two worlds hit up to each other and butt up to each other. Now, in this case, they only butt up to each other from the standpoint of the plot. They still stay separated and from one side of the globe to the other. But I have to be careful to keep them as close to one another as I can in the reader's mind. Otherwise, you'll get confused. And, you know, this time I thought I kept them pretty tight.
Hmm. So you, as you have already talked about, are utilizing a couple of people from our own history who really lived.
Yeah.
And one of them was this man by the name of Chaim Salomon.
Chaim Salomon, yeah.
You call him in the writer's note one of the unsung heroes of the American Revolution.
No question.
Tell us why we should know his name and how you utilize his legacy in this novel.
Well, we should know him very much so because he's the man who financed the American Revolution. You can't run a war without money. And he's the guy that found the money to keep the revolution going. And he also loaned the country $800,000 of his own money that kept the country going. And Washington was so appreciative of what Chaim Salomon did that he asked him, what would you like as a thank you? Salomon says, I don't want anything for me, but I'd like something for my community. And he was Jewish. So Washington said, okay, fine, this is what I'll do. On the Great Seal of the United States, above the eagle, on the back of the $1 bill, you can see the Great Seal. Above the eagle are 13 stars. And those stars supposedly were arranged to form a perfect Star of David in appreciation to Chaim Salomon. Salomon died in 1785. He never actually saw the country formed. Five times Congress has considered repayment of the money we owe Salomon. Five times Congress has said no. That debt today would be worth somewhere around $300 billion, and we've never paid him back. So to me, Salomon is as much a founding father as any of the others that we recognize.
Right. And, of course, one of the contentions of your novel is that if there were somehow proof, evidently proof that, in fact, ultimately disappeared, that such a debt, in fact, was owed,
yeah.
If proof of that could be somehow recovered or rediscovered, it would put the United States in a very uncomfortable position.
Very much so, an embarrassing position, too. What happened was the documentation for the notes that were owed to Salomon were turned over to the Pennsylvania treasurer right after his death in 1785, and that documentation just vanished. It just disappeared. And that's how Congress has refused to pay the debts back, because they say we don't have any proof that we owe him any money. Even though history says we do, they don't have any documentary proof of it.
Hmm. How about the figure of Andrew Mellon? I suspect a real student of American history might know who Mr. Mellon was. But, but many Americans would probably have no notion or only the vaguest notion.
Richest, most powerful man in America in the 1920s. Served as Secretary of Treasury for 11 years across three different presidents, which, by the way, is a tough thing to do. I hypothesized in the novel how he managed to pull that off. Franklin Roosevelt hated him, and Mellon hated Roosevelt. They had a blood feud between them. Roosevelt hated him so bad that he had him indicted for tax evasion. Mellon beat the charge, but these two men just went at it, and finally they met face-to-face on December 31st, 1936 in the White House, and that is the prologue of the novel, when these two people finally come together, and that's where the National Gallery of Art was born. I just added another element to their feud to make it even deeper and more intense, and that forms the basis of the Patriot threat. But it was fascinating to study Mellon because he was such a powerful man behind the scenes, and he was so wealthy. And he's one of those guys we don't know a whole lot about, but we need to.
Hmm. We've already touched on what in many respects is kind of the central matter here, the controversy which surrounds the creation and the ratification of the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, which of course is why all of us pay income taxes. And question has been drawn up about that process by which that ratification took place. When you kind of outline some of this in the writer's note, you say that whether these charges or concerns are in fact fully true, you leave that to the reader to determine. I think what you're saying there is you're not insisting that they're absolutely truthful, but if they're true, they make for fascinating grist for a novel.
There you go. Yeah, this is not a manifesto for not paying your taxes. We all got to pay our taxes. And it's a novel which, by definition, is not real. What it is, though, is bringing to your attention something that happened 100 years ago, something that is true, that really did happen, something that has some fascinating implications and some interesting aspects to it. And hopefully the reader will want to learn a little bit more about that and take a look at some of that. I've done several books now with the Constitution and some of these constitutional quirks. I'm fascinated by the flaws and quirks in our Constitution. And I've explored two or three of those, and I've still got a couple of more to go. And this is one that just I came across and I just couldn't resist. It just, as I said, made for a really good thriller.
Right. And, of course, I think for a lot of us living in modern America, we are intrigued by the notion that documents from over a century ago or a transaction which occurred more than 200 years ago could have such direct relevance to us today.
That's right. That's all of my books deal with that. Something from the past that's still relevant today. That's what I call the so what. You know, who cares if the 16th Amendment wasn't ratified properly? Well, okay, I'll show you why we care in a so what. Someone could use that as a weapon against us. Since, as I said, the government derives 90% of its revenues from income tax, what if they were able to avoid that and turn our own laws against us? It's like, as one of the characters in the book says, it's the cleverest weapon of mass destruction ever.
The book, again, is called The Patriot Threat, and it's published by Minotaur Books. It's the latest Cotton Malone novel by Steve Barry. Steve Barry, a great pleasure for me to speak with you on The Morning Show about your very exciting newest book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, sir.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be talking about several different children's books. One of our conversations will be with Dave Pilkey, who is famous the world over for his Captain Underpants series. He has a second series that is gaining a lot of popularity as well, called Dog Man. And we'll talk about his latest Dog Man book, which is subtitled A Tale of Two Kitties. Also, we'll be talking with Margarita Engel, responsible for a beautiful children's book that is set in beautiful Havana, Cuba. On Thursday, Nan Calvert is joining me, and with her will be Shweta Reddy, who is a really extraordinary young woman from Racine. She has helped to develop a nonprofit organization to work on issues of water, and she did so at the tender age of 11. And she will be joining us on Thursday's morning show. On Friday, a couple of different interviews, including one with Jessica DeBoer, talking about this newest season of Fine Arts at First, the wonderful art series which unfolds each and every year at First United Methodist Church.